Before going on to the next chapter of Dawn of the Dhamma, which is chapter 18, I thought I would just briefly read the passage of the conversation between the Buddha and Mahakachana that I was referring to yesterday. So this is about whether things exist or not, and also this particular teaching. This is the basis for Nagarjuna's treatise on the Middle Way, Mula Majjhimika Karika, the root of the Middle Way. So this is a very significant teaching in the general history of Buddhist thought. Now the Buddha says, "This world, Kachyana, is for the most part shackled by bias, clinging, and insistence. But one such as this, with right view, instead of becoming engaged, instead of clinging, instead of taking a stand about myself, quote-unquote, through such a bias, clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, and underlying tendency, such a one has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only dukkha arising, and what ceases is only dukkha ceasing. In this, then, knowledge is independent of others. In this way, Kachayana, it is in this way that there is right view. All exists, quote-unquote, Kachayana. This is one extreme. All does not exist. That is the other extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle way. With ignorance as condition, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as condition, consciousness comes to be." And so the whole process of dependent origination, ignorance conditioning formations, formations conditioning consciousness, consciousness conditioning mind and body, mental and material world, and that conditioning the six senses, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and then aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away, cessation, and non-arising of ignorance, there comes the cessation of volitional formations. With the cessation of volitional formations, when there are no volitional formations, there is the cessation of consciousness. Consciousness does not come to be, and so on and so forth, for each of those links of dependent origination. And so that's it's a little bit technical, but it's pointing to that, in a way, whether sort of things, quote unquote, really exist or don't exist. Is that what is pointed to here is our impression of the world and what we call the world is dependently originated. That's all we can speak about is our experience of the world, and our experience of the world arises through the conditioning of dependent origination and cause and effect. So that's an interesting source of reflection. And the fact that a philosopher like Nagarjuna is actually, I think, the only Pali Sutta he refers to by name in this particular teaching, but it's also how it became the basis for understanding what is meant by emptiness in the Buddhist world, and Nagarjuna made much more of that than you get in the whole of the Tibetan Buddhist field, that what is understood as emptiness is that things are empty of their own self essence. So there is no sort of rather unlike what Plato said about the world of the realm of pure forms, that there isn't an essential book here. There's a coming together of elements that do booking for a while, and then they, after a time, they stop booking. and so understanding, this is what, when we talk about empty, empty of self existence, empty of fundamental substance. That's what is meant is chiefly that what has come together for that moment is something that is dependently originated and conditioned. So, on to chapter 18, and this is the realms of the guardians. So we get very colourful in these particular realms. You've got The Buddha is dressed rather like you have here. This in a Deva Raja mode, and also the white Buddha here with a whole crown and dramatic aura and so forth. So that the Buddha formed as a Deva Raja, like a king of Devas, and so you have that here as well. You've got the cobra-headed naga with several heads. Seven heads, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, seven-headed naga, and then the Buddha with a headdress and armbands and the whole sort of royal regalia. And that's not that the Buddha would have walked around dressed like that in his normal monastic life, but there's this, the iconography of some rupas and some images as the Buddha appears in this form of a sort of a royal deva. And then up above, you have these beings kneeling here. These are the four guardians. And then below, so even though the next heaven up will be the heaven of the 33, the Tavatimsa heaven will be higher, quote unquote, it's lower because we start reading words at the top and we read down the page. So you've got the part of the sutta that refers to the four kings is up here, and then the Tavatimsa heaven is down here. And so it's visually it's a bit the other way around, but I'm sure you get the picture. And then you have the sort of pink and mauve coloration of the Deva realm below there. And then you have the central figure of the Buddha. And again, as Ajahn Sucitto was saying, the Dhamma wheel is getting a little bit more sort of less wheel-like and a bit more decorated. You've got flower petals around the edge and then radiance coming out. The spokes are being replaced by just these sort of wavy lines of radiance emanating out from the center, so that the Dhamma is beginning to get lost in the brightness. And so we have the Pali here for this section. Pumhanang devanang sadhang suttava chattu maharajika deva sadhamanusave sung. Chattu maharajika nang deva nang sadang suttava tavating sa deva sadhamanusave sung. So the English for that reads, when they heard what the earth devas had said, the devas of the realm of the four great kings cried out with one voice. At Varanasi, in the deer park, the matchless wheel of Dhamma has been set rolling. And when they heard the cry of the devas of the realm of the four great kings, then the devas of the realm of the 33 cried out with one voice. And so you have this very beautiful, colorful painting. Again, you've got some of green Celtic knotwork, the remains of the Bhuma Deva realms of floating around there. You've got some planets and stars and moons and other such like things. You've actually got the cosmos is drifting out of the nostrils of this green dragon down in the corner. You've got that if you look carefully, you've got the night sky with stars and planets and such like appearing from the nostrils of the naga down in the bottom left-hand corner as you look at it. So Ajahn Sucitto is getting very colourful and imaginative in his expressions here. So they all start celebrating. The earth devas start off, and then the devas of the realm of the four great kings join in. And then the cry goes up and up, with each celestial realm being succeeded by higher ones. In the two realms depicted here, guidance and personal responsibility are very important. The Chatuha Maharajika Deva Loka is the realm of the four great kings, who are the Lokapalas, or world guardians. In this sense, they represent the consciousness of the world rather than being comic book superheroes who wear skin-tight leotards and do battle with extraterrestrial villains with names like Smaug and the Exterminator. They do look a little bit like comic book superheroes, but they represent the consciousness of the world rather than being comic book superheroes who wear skin-tight leotards and do battle with extraterrestrial villains with names like Smaug and the Exterminator. The Lokapala style of guardianship is more befitting to celestials with ethereal bodies. In the last half of the 20th century, people began to consider that the planet and all forms of life on it, the climate, and the mixture of chemicals in the air and water might exist in a sensitive balance that is somehow self-regulating. It does not appear to be ruled by a creator God separate from it. But to say that it is not directed would be the opposite view, the materialistic view that has led to the gross and selfish exploitation of planet Earth and all forms of life by humankind. Nowadays, scientists are beginning to talk about a self-regulating principle guarding the planet. They call it Gaia. In ancient civilizations, it was the Earth Mother, or Sky God, or Great Spirit. In Buddhist cosmology, it is the four great kings and the devata of the 33 who live on the world mountain, Mount Meru. So the four great kings, the Chaturmaharajika Deva, they are said to rule over particular sections of devas, so that when we chant the 28 Buddhas, we chant the names of the four great kings, which of course I won't be able to remember off the top of my head. But Virupaka is one, and Dattarata is another, Virulaka is another, and
Kuvera,
thank you, is the fourth one. And so one is the head of the Naga realm, one of the dragons, one is the head of the Gandavas, the celestial musicians, one is the head of the Yakas, one is the head of the earth spirits, so that they each one has their own department, as it were, and then they also govern the directions, so that you have Purimadi Sang Dattarato. So that's in the east, there is Dattarata, Dakinena, and then in the south is Virulaka, who is the guardian of the Gandavas, and then so too with the west, and then in the north you have the head of the Yakas. Kuvera is the ruler of the Yakas, or the celestial demons. They come from Uttarakuru in the north. So there's a whole intricate mythology that's woven around these. But also, I'm not sure if Ajahn Sajito will go into it in detail, but also the word Lokapala is used to refer to the qualities of what's called Hiri Otapa. And if you go into the temple, when you look in the temple, you notice there's a deva on either side of the doors. One's got a pale blue surround, the other one's got a pink surround. Well, those represent Hiri and Otapa, and they're also called the Lokapala, or the guardians of the world. So whereas these characters, the four Maharajas, are the external rulers, or the guardians in terms of the celestial cosmology, Hiri and Otapa, who are usually not represented in a sort of human type form, but tend to be more spoken of as psychological qualities. It was because of the inspiration of George Sharp, actually, when they first had the idea to build an oppositor hall at Chithurst, he had seen in the past that quite rarely, but occasionally, Hiri and Otapa would be represented in material form, and so he had a plan. The original idea was to build an oppositor hall right out in the lake, and there was going to be this long sort of causeway, this little walkway out to the oppositor hall in the middle of the lake, and there was going to be a statue of Hiri and Otapa either side of the gateway leading onto the causeway. I think the West Sussex County Council had something to say about the prospect of building on a platform in the middle of the lake, so that didn't take off. But when we built the temple here, we still had the idea of having Hiri and Otapa as the guardians of the temple door. So Pang China Sai, who comes here regularly on the weekend, he was commissioned to paint those two images. And Hiri is there's different ways of it being explained, but probably the most accurate and helpful way. Hiri is your conscience. It's that discomfort that you feel. If I tell a lie, or if I say something that's unkind, if I... if I say to, say, Ajahn Ahingsako, conveniently here on my left, that anybody who spent a career as a ballet dancer must be a total idiot, really. Which is an insulting, which he did. but it's an insulting statement. So if I say that, and then that sort of twinge in the heart that goes, oh, that wasn't very kind. Well, what a cruel thing to say. That's pretty stupid. That rent, that sort of twinge, that wrench in your heart, that is hiri. That's your own sense of conscience. So, sometimes called a sense of shame, which is, and it's killed. And even though hiri and otapa are painful feelings, they're the guardians of the heart. Just as physical pain protects you from physical injury, like if I put my finger in a candle flame, ow, it hurts. That pain protects you, because if it didn't hurt, you just keep your hand in the candle flame, and then you get a serious injury. So hiri otapa are like emotional pain that help us to protect our heart. And so that sense of shame or that conscience is when you steal something, or you're hurtful, or you take advantage of someone, or you're deceitful. It's that pain in the heart that is felt. And when the ego grabs hold of that, then that becomes a guilt trip, and it feeds self-hatred. But ideally, it's not identified with, but recognizing that was unskillful. That's not a very beautiful thing to say. Or that was really dishonest or unfair. And so then that painfulness of the feeling encourages you not to do it anymore, or to apologize for having done it. And then otapa is explained in various different ways, but what I find is the best way of considering it is otapa is when you see something that's being done that's cruel. So if you see somebody else lying to someone, if you see someone hurting somebody else, that feeling of pain that you experience, that sort of recoiling from that, drawing away from that, is otapa. So that seeing the repulsive quality of unskillfulness in the world, that when you don't want to be part of that, or people are acting violently or greedily or indulgently, ooh. So again, that's not being judgmental or proud or conceited. That's just ooh. That's, you know, what a horrible thing to do to yourself. And there's an image that the Buddha uses, like if you put a feather or a sinew, like a tendon from a muscle, if a tendon is dropped into a fire, then it'll coil up and it'll retreat from the flame. It kind of draws back on its own, even though the animal's not alive, but the tendon will curl up and pull away from the fire. So in the same way, the heart recoils, it draws away from unskillful action and is pained or is repelled by unskillful action in the world. So hiri and otapa, they're painful emotional states, but it's good pain. And someone who is, the more spiritually mature someone is, the more hiri otapa they feel. And so that... So it's said that someone who's an arahant can't even, their tongue cannot form a lie. Their hand cannot move to deliberately harm another creature. This, like, it won't, the body won't cooperate. And similarly, for someone who's, you know, less than an arahant, if they're very spiritually mature and they do tell a lie, or they do say something that is so deliberately hurtful, it'll really hurt. Because even if it's just a sort of a slightly intolerant comment or a kind of sarcastic remark, someone who's spiritually very mature might feel that all day long, like a stone in their shoe. Whereas someone who's less spiritually mature will not even notice. They won't even notice that they said anything hateful, or they'll be glad that they said it. Ha ha ha. I showed her, and so hiri otapa is a sign of a spiritual maturity, and so it's very important in that to tease those things apart from the sort of the habits of self view. I'm an awful person. I'm a terrible liar. I shouldn't have said that. I'm really so greedy. I'm so awful. I'm so jealous, and. That's self-view grabbing hold of hiri otapa and making more suffering out of it. But on its own, it's extremely valuable. It's a very beautiful quality, it's something that to be rejoiced in. That it really hurts when you are cruel to someone. Like, good. That's a healthy sign. And so rather than thinking, I need to just toughen up and get over it, I should just be able to lie and not make a thing out of it. No. That's called stupidity. So trying to override our moral sensitivity by just blotting things out is a very foolish, understandable. I did quite a lot of it myself, but it's a very foolish way to guide your life. So to continue, the Buddhist emphasis is on mind and consciousness. This, for beings with consciousness, is the access point to the subtle forces that govern the world of nature. Consciousness is a subtle, localized, and highly developed aspect of creation. Within its immaterial forms are the patterns that abide in the material sphere. Okay, within its immaterial forms, so mind as in the is formless, it has no material form. Within the immaterial forms of consciousness are the patterns that abide in the material sphere, so that we build our patterns of thinking and perceiving on the material world, our bodies and the buildings and trees and sky and the material world within us and around us. Consciousness is the world in which Mount Meru is a symbol for the upright, centered mind, the axis mundi, the central pole of our being. If Mount Meru is secure from corruption and upheaval, the world system is in order. If the human mind is clear and uncorrupted by delusions, hatred, pride, and intoxication, then our world is balanced. So Mount Meru, or Sumeru, or Sineru, they're all that's referring to the same thing. So it's the myth of the world mountain that you have in many different kinds of mythologies. Mount Kailash is one of the reasons it's a pilgrimage place is because it has a lot of characteristics. The mythology of the world mountain, the central pillar of the world, has that it's a freestanding mountain. It's very symmetrical. It's not made of the same rock as the other mountains around it, and four of the great rivers of India all begin there. So it became a pilgrimage place thousands of years ago. Also, they have other mythologies have a similar, not necessarily a mountain. Like in Norse mythology, they had the world ash. The Yggdrasil was the sort of giant ash tree that was the central axis of the world. So you have various mythologies have this image of this central axis of the world, like an axle that the wheel of the world spins on. And Ajahn Sucitto is very eloquently phrasing it here. If Mount Meru is secure from corruption and upheaval, the world system is in order. If the human mind is clear and uncorrupted by delusions, hatred, pride, and intoxication, then our world is balanced. So that awareness is the axis mundi in our internal world. In this analysis, the uprightness of the mind implies more than is normally meant by a simple moral standard. It signifies a whole view on the world and on life, in which the ego is dethroned from being the moral arbiter and center of the universe. So that we're not making ego, and the I is not the axis of the world, me, but so the ego is dethroned from being the center of the world. And in Buddhist social convention, the ideal ruler, referred to as the wheel-turning monarch, was one who was invested with the 10 righteous principles, or Raja Dhammas. These are generosity, virtuous conduct, self-sacrifice, honesty, integrity, gentleness, self-control, calmness, non-violence, patient forbearance, and conformity to the principles of Dhamma. These qualities are regarded as the proper rulers of the world, whether this is the external social world or the microcosm of our own person. While these principles are firm, Mount Meru, the stable balance within the individual and in society, is secure. When these are decaying, the converse is true, with effects that manifest in wider contexts, such as the increase in violent crime, suicide, and drug abuse. And then the Buddha says, this is in the Book of the Threes, when people are consumed by improper desires, overwhelmed by corrupt ambitions, obsessed by wrong ideals, the rainfall dwindles. It's hard to get a meal. The crops are bad, afflicted with mildew and stunted. Because of this, many people perish. This is one of the Buddha's statements on ecological preservation, and also because people cutting down trees and destroying the land, and the rainfall reduces, and then food is hard to get, and then there's a general degeneration of society. The Buddha saw an intimate connection between the world of consciousness and the natural world. Self-view in consciousness always affects the attitudes and the motivations that, in turn, affect the world at large. It doesn't take a completely enlightened being to realize that today's environmental problems stem from greed and wrong values which manifest as personal wealth pursued at the expense of others. And and again, even though he was talking about the world as a earlier on with the Gaia hypothesis and the world as a self-regulating system, it's also the recognizing that, as the Buddha did, that human greed and delusion has a big part. It's part of that natural system that is, it creates an imbalance, and then the system needs then to right itself. But that seeing that ecological degradation is a very direct result of human greed and insensitivity, and as he puts it here, the environmental problems that stem from greed and wrong values which manifest as personal wealth pursued at the expense of others. So that, you know, I want to have particular things, possessions or amenities or things for my home and my vehicles to drive or gadgets to use that depend on whole industries of mining and deforestation, the use of oil and so on and so forth, that because I want to have a particular set of things or a particular standard of living that I feel is normal, we can be completely unconscious of the impact that those desires have upon the world around us. I think I'm not sure if I mentioned it earlier, this particular session of readings, but I was very struck many years ago, probably 20, 25 years ago. It was a Greenpeace advert, I believe. It was like a full page, it was a two-page advert, really. It was like probably in the Guardian. And it had on the first page, it was the full page, it had these small pictures, like many, many square pictures. And there was like a power station with fumes billowing out of the big chimneys, and a pipe with this sort of frothing liquid pouring out into a stream. It had stacks of car tires burning and great smoke pouring off them, and also various other a tree or a bunch of grass and various people, a couple of kids in an African village, a little white baby, and a big an old guy with a fat stomach and a big white moustache and a cigar, and the question of so all these different graphic pictures, and then the caption at the bottom was, which one of these is responsible for the greatest environmental destruction? And so that you either pick the sort of steaming factory chimneys or the burning tires or the big tycoon with the cigar, and then you turn the page and there's one picture and it's a white baby. It's the sort of Caucasian child, and lying there on a blanket with a big smile, and says, "In the course of a lifetime, that one white child from in a first world country will be responsible, because of all the stuff they consume, they'll be responsible for more ecological destruction than the, say, pollutants coming from a chemical factory or from dumping plastics in the ocean and so on and so forth." And it was a compelling picture. And certainly it was designed to get you thinking, and I still it works. I still can remember it 25 years later. But this is pointing to, in terms of our consciousness and the sense of of Hiriyotapa and the guardians of the world, that that helps us to ask that question: how much do I need? You know, how willing am I to just keep using the same stuff over and over again and keep repairing it rather than getting something new and throwing the old away and just letting the earth have to swallow up all the mountains of plastic and heavy metals and such like that get consumed with my appetites, and what's the impact that we're having upon the planet with our tastes and choices. So the devata of the four great kings and the realm of the 33 are mostly connected to energies in consciousness. As such, they are frequently mentioned as seeking advice from the Buddha. Saka, also known as Indra, is the ruler of both realms. In this painting, he is depicted being carried by a yaka, a kind of genie or ogre, kneeling in front of a Buddha who appears in the regalia of a wheel-turning monarch. So it's like the Devaraja Buddha. The four great kings are immediately above. In the east, he's got the names here. In the east is Dattarata. He is generally accompanied by the white devata called Gandharvas. So those are the celestial musicians, or Gandharvas in Sanskrit, the skilled musicians mentioned previously. When they are in charge of things, the east is a serene quarter. Virulaka is the king of the south. He oversees this quarter with the help of some kumbandas. And kumbandas means a pot belly. So the kumbandas are sort of gnome-like beings with pot bellies and short limbs. So a kumba is a pot. There's the pot-bellied demons. You often see them in Buddhist imagery. In the ancient stupa of Amaravati, they're often sort of sitting underneath, holding things up in the reliefs. So you got a couple of, or several of these hefty guys holding up a building or carrying a huge naga. So that they in the Western architecture, they have the same role as what are called caryatids. They're like similarly represented as human figures or deva-like figures that are sort of carrying a building or carrying something on their shoulders or on their backs. So the kumbandas, they're down in the south. The guardian of the north is called Vaisavanna, or sometimes called Kuveru, and he is accompanied by a host of yakas. Those are the celestial demons. And the west is guarded by Virupaka, who has a band of nagas to back him up. So when we do the chant, Virupake Hime, we're addressing Virupaka, the head of the dragons. The Virupaka is the sort of chief naga. And also, according to legend, Virupaka, the head of the Nagas, he's supposed to live in Lake Manasarova near Mount Kailash. So they say, according to local legend, it's the sort of Naga Raja, the head Naga of the world, lives in Lake Manasarova, and that Lake Manasarova is mentioned in the suttas. It's Lake Anuttata in the Pali suttas, which means no heat. It's a cold country. And the Buddha occasionally flew there and would sit by Lake Anuttata and meditate, or sometimes it's described as him going there to take his meal sometimes. So that Virupaka, that's supposed to be the dwelling place of the Naga Raja. So Virupaka, his is quite a team, because Nagas are giant serpents who draw upon and embody the rhythmic flowing power of water and the moon. These are the four celestial guardians who try to defend the four corners of the world by keeping it free from demonic energies. Like Indra and the Devata of the 33, they're often called upon to defend Mount Meru from attacks of the Asuras, the selfish fallen gods of conceit, pride, and power. However, like all the devas, they are very much affected by the activities of the human realm. When there's a lot of killing, stealing, lying, and greed, that sets up a pretty unpleasant vibration, which makes it difficult for them to function properly. Judging from conditions in the world today, these devatas seem to be sorely pressed to keep the asuras and demons at bay. They have a high sense of responsibility and concern for the world, so they rejoice when Buddhas appear in the world to advise human beings how to live wisely. And even though this book was published in about 1995. That was 20 years ago. Somehow or other, the world still hasn't quite found perfect peace yet. So these comments are still very pertinent after all this time. Also, Inda Osaka was a regular student of the Buddha. So there's a sutta called the Sakka Panha, where Osaka comes to the Buddha and asks various questions. And also there's a very interesting discourse where the devas and the asuras have just had a big battle, and the devas won and the asuras were defeated, and then and Saka built this big palace, the Vijayanta palace, as a sort of celebration after the war was over. And there's a scene where he's showing Mahamogalana around his new palace, and so he demonstrated 700 rooms and all these kind of beautiful decorations, and it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. And as Saka is showing Mahamogalana around his new palace, Mogalana thinks, this devata is completely deluded. You know, he's obsessed with furnishings and architecture, and he's completely lost in this whole building program that he's been involved in. And so I'm not really interested in this palace just as an object of beauty. Maybe I can do something to awaken awaken a bit of perspective in him. And Mogalana reaches down with his foot and touches the floor of the palace with his big toe and causes an earthquake. Suddenly the whole palace shakes. And that of course, gets Saka's attention. And so then he's realized, oh yeah, I was getting a bit lost in my home improvements and furnishings. And all right, what was I thinking of? Right, yeah, Anicca, yes, thank you very much. And then Mogalana sort of summarizes what he was teaching, and he uses this phrase, Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya. And that's what that means is nothing whatsoever should be clung to. And I think it's called the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta, the lesser discourse on the destruction of craving. And in that statement, then it said, one who has heard this has heard all things. One who has practiced this has practiced all things. One who has understood this has understood all things. One who has fully awakened to and fully embodied this insight has fully awakened to all things. And so that the result of Saka receiving that teaching, then that is a very dramatic statement that is made there. Like if you know this, you know everything. If you really embody this insight, you've done everything. So it's no small thing. And Ajahn Buddhadasa used to say that if you can summarize the whole Tipitaka into those four words, Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya. So he would take that teaching and say, if you know this, you know everything. He took that seriously and would say, you can summarize the entire Pali canon into those four words. Don't cling to anything. So the next realm above the four great kings is the realm of the 33, Tavatingsa, which is shown in the lower half of the painting. This realm is variously described as inhabited by 33 devata, or a ruling committee of 33, which is a bit more likely. It is, of course, fantastically beautiful and pleasant. It's a sociable world. There are frequent meetings in the great hall, gatherings to listen to celestial concerts, and sometimes guest deities, a visiting arahant or the Buddha himself, drop in to talk on the subject of Dhamma. And so, again, you have this lower section of the painting, all this sort of wash of mauve and pink. This is representing the heaven of the 33 down here. And Indra, or Saka, is the ruler of that. So personally, I think that the 33 is referring to the sort of the ruling committee, as it were, and because you often have other references to many, many other devatas that are living there or gathered there. So this realm, the Tavatingsa, is the normal abode of Inda in Pali, or Indra in Sanskrit, who is one of the supreme gods of the Vedas, the ancient religious texts which predate Buddhism. Just as the early Christians absorbed aspects of native religions by canonizing their barbaric gods, the Buddhist transformed Indra from a thunderbolt-wielding sky warrior to a righteous monarch, lover of the Dhamma and disciple of the Buddha. So like, say, for example, in Ireland, St. Bridget was a protective deity before the Christians came along. And used to protect wells and springs, and so then when the Christians arrived in Ireland, then they co-opted her, and she became a Christian saint. But she was around as a sort of protective deity of springs and wells, you know, long before Christianity arrived in Ireland. And also, in terms of thunderbolt wielding gods, we have Zeus, Greek mythology, and Woden, in Northern European. And so that Indra in the Vedic mythology is very much the same kind of role: big king, gets angry, good fighter, you know, likes to throw thunderbolts. And so that then the Indra of as Ajahn Sajito says, that he does have, you know, he can throw a good thunderbolt when he's fighting the asuras, but he's also a lover of Dhamma. So they're frequently his devotion to the Buddha and his keenness to understand the teaching and to practice it. Just as when Moggallana touches the floor with his toe and creates an earthquake, Sakka is very quick to sort of remember the teachings that he's heard. In one of the suttas, the Sakkapanha Sutta, there you go, Indra, having recognized that his time was drawing to an end, puts forth renewed spiritual zeal and attains stream entry. He takes his position as a celestial ruler quite seriously. In the Jataka stories, Indra acts as a witness to the great being's practices of supreme paramita, intervening from time to time to put the great being to the test, which will enable him to manifest his great virtues. One time, Indra appeared as a hungry Brahmin when the great being was a hare and asked him for some food. The hare, having no food to offer, responded by offering his own body as food and throwing himself on a fire to cook, after shaking off all the fleas out of his fur. So the story was that Indra had disguised himself as a Brahmin, living as a yogi in the forest, and had a little cook fire burning in front of him. And then this hare came along and wanted to offer itself as food, and then it jumped into the fire there in the little forest glade. At that moment, the fire went cold. And he said that the flames were still there, but the flames didn't have any heat in them. And Indra proclaimed the self-sacrifice of the hare. And as a lasting testimonial, he drew the hare's face onto the surface of the moon. So in the East, as probably the Asian people here, they know that you see a hare with the long ears on the face of the moon. In Europe, we just have it made as green cheese and such like. Well, the clangers live up there. Those who remember the clangers. Now, these accounts define Indra as a righteous ruler of realms that are ethically sympathetic to the human realm and interested in its welfare. We should also recognize that Indra, like the realms themselves, plays a part in the human mind. Indra is related to the word Indriya, the five spiritual faculties that govern the contemplative mind. These are faith, sadha, energy, virya, mindfulness, sati, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, panya. If these are not developed in a balanced way, spiritual cultivation is patchy. When the proper ruler, quote-unquote, is present in terms of spiritual practice, or in terms of relationships and duties in the world, the mind is upright and there is a feeling of rightness, so uprightness and balance. There is a kind of happiness, less gleeful, but more flexible and useful, that comes from being balanced and well-guided within oneself. This is the well-being of these celestial realms. However, one has to realize that the extent of this ruling principle is changeable. One can't expect the world to always be under harmonious rule, or the society, or the family. Even in the Sangha during the time of the Buddha, there was plenty of disharmony, squabbling and corruption, and much the same is true today. In my experience, monasteries go through cycles of inspiration and gloom, and people get disillusioned and things become difficult. So this is very true, but I think it's a very, very useful connection to make, that when we talk about the five Indriya, they're called the five spiritual faculties, but that it directly relates to Indra as a god. So it's representing that quality of force or energy and the sense of rulership. So it's within that you have mindfulness at the center, and it's also that quality of balance is reflected in the classical way of speaking about the Indriya, is that mindfulness is at the very center, and then on either side you have concentration, samadhi, and virya, and the energy and concentration need to be balanced. So if there's too much concentration and not enough energy, then you'll get dull and fall asleep. If there's too much energy and not enough concentration, then the mind gets scattered and confused, so that they balance around samadhi as the axis of that. And then the other two, panya and saddha, faith and wisdom. So if you have too much wisdom and not enough faith, then the mind becomes skeptical and critical and is absorbed into conceptual thought. Too much faith and not enough wisdom, then you become a sort of starry-eyed airhead. And, oh, wow, fantastic, I'm really happy about it. And the mind lacks discriminating wisdom. So faith and wisdom also need to be balanced with each other, so that way that Ajahn Sajito is speaking here is very, very, very helpful. And so that rather than just thinking, oh, this is talking about a heavenly realm somewhere else with this sort of big royal dude who throws out thunderbolts at the center, that's also talking about our inner world, and that mindfulness is the thunderbolt wielding character at the center, but also that which loves the Dhamma and wants to practice and to awaken. Okay, maybe just a little bit more on this chapter. I'll read it through to the end. Attachment to this realm of social order means that you worship the Buddha as the epitome of everything working out in an orderly and peaceful way. Then you suffer when it changes, and you get disillusioned with Buddhism. But the Buddha never said, "Stick with me and everything will work out well. Believe in me and you'll never be disappointed by injustice in the world or by corrupt monks or apathetic nuns. You're on the winning team." Okay, and you wouldn't believe how many times when people ask for blessings, they want their kids to get through their exams, or they want to have a baby, or they're moving into a new house, or they've got a hearing about their immigration appeal coming up. And I, this is exactly what I say over and over and over again. So look, the Buddha never said, if you take refuge in the Triple Gem, or if you get sprinkled with some holy water, you get a piece of string tied in your wrist, nothing bad will happen to you. That does not get said or even hinted at a single time. But the Buddha instead said, the conditions that support the apparent world are impermanent. Keep practicing diligently. But everything's impermanent and uncertain. So we can wish each other well, and then if we remember nothing is certain, everything changes, and then that will be what serves us best. So maybe you'll pass the exam, maybe not, but at least you won't suffer so much if you fail. And if you succeed, you won't get drunk on it. And so that whichever way things go, then the teachings will benefit you. But people say, yeah, well, can you give me a sprinkling anyway? So that's the way we are as humans. So he said, the conditions that support the apparent world are impermanent. Keep practicing diligently. Vayadama sankara appama dena sampadeta is the Pali. That's the refuge of the Dhamma. And as you can see in this painting, attachment to perceptions of fairness, rightness, and harmony weakens the impression of that Dhamma wheel. So attachment to perceptions of fairness, rightness, and harmony weakens the impression of the Dhamma wheel. Like I said, the wheel is starting to disappear behind the bright lights and the purple flushes. The beings of these two Devaloka also see the Buddha in their terms as a being of supreme, though benevolent, power. This kind of Buddha is called a Dhammaraja, the Buddha as king of the Dhamma. He appears in the human realm too, giving confidence to Buddhists in the centuries after the master's decease. Such a figure was occasionally carved in stone in the Buddhist kingdoms of India. And we have these right here in Amaravati as well. Perhaps he wrote that before this image was given here. From around the first century BC, Buddhist iconography developed in northern India for devotional purposes. Gradually, there emerged a pantheon of Buddhist saints, bodhisattvas, and Buddhas. This stems from the human mind's natural inclination towards the physical human form rather than towards the abstract, "this is the way things are," quote unquote. Kundanya's insight that everything that arises passes away can fail to have much impact on a human mind, because saying about cause and effect doesn't really kind of pluck on the heartstrings. You can overlook that in a moment, couldn't you? But that desire to find a guru or a leader or to be able to personify the teaching in a physical form is a very strong tendency for a human being. From this desire to personify the teaching comes the tendency to glorify this human form. In this picture, we already see the Dhamma wheel looking vague and faint behind this powerful figure. So, over time, unless there is a community or a good consistent teaching that keeps inclining towards Dhamma, it's easy to miss the point and get involved with the qualities of the teacher. "I've got to be like that teacher, then I'll be an enlightened being." This again is an example of the origin of suffering rather than the cessation of it, because of course it's not up to any of us to be like anyone else. But if we apply ourselves to Dhamma, we can be uniquely ourselves, and that is good enough. We need not invest this mundane mortal form with charisma. However, to have this kind of confidence in the way it is requires penetration of the Dhamma rather than inspiration from a teacher. The devas don't have that understanding in Dhamma because they can't keep track of things arising and passing away. Devas live for at least 10,000 years, so they have little recollection of death. When they finally die, they do so very discreetly. Their twinkle goes out. They're just not seen anymore. And everyone says, "Do you remember what happened to who? Peel me another grape." They're forgotten. It's the same with us humans. Just consider, when you're feeling captivated, high and inspired, how much do you really remember of everything that arises and passes away? You have to be fairly grounded to recognize that even the higher aspects of mind are impermanent conditions. On that aspect of iconography, it's also significant that in the era of the original Amaravati, back in about 2,000 years ago in southern India, and what you find from the Ashokan era, the old stupas and inscriptions and carvings, that the Buddha was never represented in human form. So rather like you have in the Jewish tradition or the Muslim tradition, that there's a non-representation of reality in the human form. So with the early sort of people, the British colonial types in India who were trying to figure out the ancient Indian religions, they didn't realize that many of these shrines and sculptures and carvings were all related to the same religion. They thought there was a tree cult here and there's a snake cult there, and there's not sure what these footprints meant, but maybe there are big feet worshippers. And so that then over several decades they began to piece it all together, and particularly when they had decoded the Brahmi script of the ancient inscriptions of the Ashokan pillars and such like, they began to realize, oh, these are all actually they're referring to the same person. They're referring to the Buddha. But it was because the Buddha was never represented in human form. Sometimes the footprints, the sort of stylized footprints, would represent the Buddha. Or the Bodhi tree, the space under the Bodhi tree, would represent the Buddha. Or an empty chair. And so it was only after, they say, when the Greeks, when Alexander invaded northern India, and the Greeks brought their iconography of depicting their deities in human form, that then they started using those human forms for creating images of the Buddha. So the earliest images of the Buddha that we know of in Gandhara and Taxila, that area, they look like Greek gods, like Apollo. And if you look at the sort of Gandhara, some, and the bodhisattvas have nice sort of curly moustaches, like Greek warriors and such. So that that was where the representation of the Buddha in human form seems to have begun. In the northern Buddhist world, they've got different legends. So they actually have stories of the images of the Buddha being carved in human form during the Buddha's own lifetime. But in the southern Buddhist world, and it's and also the iconography you find in India, that it's only after the Greek period that you get images in a human shape, and so that when they were conceiving the temple, with Lumpo Sumedho having conversations with the architect, and the architect had been studying. He built the Peace Pagoda at Battersea and the one at Milton Keynes. So he'd studied a lot of Japanese iconography, and so then when he was commissioned to build the temple here, he started looking into India, and he travelled to Sri Lanka and India, and did a bit of background research, and he discovered this principle of like the non-representation of the Buddha in human form. So he thought, great, fantastic. And then he had these conversations with Lumpo. He said, well, yeah, that's fantastic. Ajahn Buddhadasa, where I first heard of Amaravati, was at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery. And he was really keen on that too. And so one of the main meditation areas, you know, the shrine doesn't have a Buddha rupa, it's got a rock sitting on the shrine. And so for a while, there was this enthusiasm about having an empty chair up on the shrine instead of a Buddha image. That was, and so Tom was already getting a plan of how to design the chair to copy one of the ones from the carvings of the ancient Amaravati. And then Lumpo Sumedho, as he tends to do, reflected upon this and then sort of brought it to mind and said, well, I really like the symbol of it. It's very meaningful to me. But if we do that, I'm going to have to explain that so many times. How many thousands and thousands of people are going to ask, why is there a chair up on the shrine instead of a Buddha? And no, forget it. So that plan was scratched, and then he commissioned the rupa that's there now to be made in Thailand. But for a while, it was going to be a sort of stylized ancient Indian chair was going to be the main shrine here at Amaravati. So any questions or things for clarification, please ask away.
I do have one question, Ajahn. In the temple, just as you enter the temple, mm-hmm. there's a picture of Ottapa and Hiri.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't tell the difference which is male and female.
Well, maybe they're... they're both male and female. Well, the pink one might be the female one and the blue one might be the male. But I would hate to suggest there was some kind of typecasting. Yeah. When I was at kindergarten, the boys had a blue bathroom because most of the kids couldn't read, so then blue was for the boys and pink was for the girls. But I don't think that necessarily Pang had that in mind. So, and also, beyond a certain stage, devas don't have gender. They are, the Brahma gods don't have any gender.
They
nope. And I don't know if it's ever specified that, you know, how sort of, what sort of realm Hiri and Ottapa actually abide in. I mean, it would make sense that they are part of the realm of the four Maharajas. I've never actually seen it written down, but I don't think it really matters very much. You can think of them as both female or both male or one of each or both a bit of both. It's more important to be cultivating that, to have some a bit of both on the inside. Yeah. Ask Pang. Do you know him? Pang was the one who painted them. If you ask him, I'm sure he'll tell you. There's probably some...
Yes, I have another question regarding what you said before about the... there was an example about the factory and then the white child being like the origin of this kind of...
The what?
Yeah, before you mentioned that the image of a factory,
mm-hmm.
the fumes...
Yes.
That. And then the Caucasian child being the origin or...
Mm-hmm. Cause more and during the course of a lifetime. Say if that Caucasian child lives for 70 years during that period, then there's.
But actually, it seems like for many people in the world, this is like a great thing. Like, yeah, there's been more factories built. Yeah, so mm-hmm. what would you say to those people in the terrible countries that it's actually not the solution for the problems?
I'm not quite sure what you're saying.
Yeah, because sometimes it's associated, like the more material riches you have, the better life you're going to have, the more opportunities you have. So I think for many people in the developing countries, they think that you have more factories, you have more products, is a better thing.
Well, it can be, but then it's because if we are, I mean, just the term consumer society, to me, the very fact that term exists is a sign of craziness, that we define ourselves by the fact that we consume. What we are is consuming. That's kind of weird, but we use the word all the time. So, but the point being, if we reduce the level of consuming, then maybe the factories overseas in China or in Guatemala or in Indonesia, that they've got less stuff to sell overseas, but maybe then instead of just selling stuff, making stuff there and selling it cheaply to the consumers of the West, then there's other ways that we can structure our lives and create a quality of well-being. Rather than just how much cash can be got by selling these products that people are going to use for 6 months before they throw them away. And so that if there's a... it's not saying you want to just reduce the market so that people will be able to sell less stuff in the people who are living in the other parts of the world, but rather thinking about how we... spend our time. What are the things that are really going to benefit a society? Does everything depend upon how much can be sold to support the welfare of individual families in poorer countries, or what do people in the richer countries really need? So it's with greater wisdom in the mix and more of a concern. Like in Bhutan, they developed this concept of gross national happiness rather than gross national product, so that they and it's a serious issue. It's also interesting that Bhutan is a country of only about 700,000 people, but the people from the Bhutanese government get invited to like these G8 conferences to explain to the high up financiers and political people from like France and Canada and Brazil and such, like how those principles work and how they can apply them, because they're looking at human well-being as the most important thing, and the amount of cash is secondary to that. So to me, I think it's a very inspired and skillful way of reconfiguring our thoughts, and so that you're measuring that sense of well-being on a practical and lived level in a society. Right, that's how you measure how good things are or how poor things are, by human well-being, and that you are, if you make that a priority, then there's a lot of choices that get made along the way. So maybe your factories produce less stuff, but maybe the people actually have better water, better clinics, better education, and that the quality of life really increases. But I'm not an expert in eco-friendly politics. But yes?
I have a question about the devas. I wonder, what's your vision about how they exist? Do you see it as thousands of them are listening to this talk right now? Do you see them?
Unless they've walked off in disgust or flown off.
No, or do they exist as mental perceptions, like, so that they are produced by our own minds? I wonder how you look at that.
Well, both ways, really. I've never had a problem with the idea of different realms of existence. I grew up reading fairy tales and myths and legends. You can probably tell by the stuff I talk about. I never read war stories or kind of, or the normal thing that kind of boys get given, encyclopedias of battleships and such. None of that interested me. But I was always reading about fairies and dragons and mythical realms. And so I've always been quite comfortable with the idea of of other realms of existence happening simultaneous to this one. I've never met any devatas or talked with any pixies or leprechauns or dragons, but I have no idea. I have no problem with the idea that they are around. We do live in a world where there's a lot of invisible things, right? Like if I took out a cell phone, it would tell me whether we can get a signal here. That this room is filled with microwaves from the broadcasting cell phone towers. Probably you could get the Wi-Fi from the Amravati system here as well, happening right here in this room. If you had a radio, turn the radio on, you could pick up a radio station. If you had a TV, you could pick up a TV broadcast. It's all happening right here in this room. Cosmic radiation, if you had a Geiger counter, tick, 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 it would tell you all of the radiation that's pouring down through this building right now. As we sit here, so you've got microwaves, radio waves, TV, Wi-Fi, cosmic rays, neutrinos blasting through the planet. It's all happening here, but we can't see it. We can't perceive it. If we were particular kinds of insects, we'd be able to see infrared or ultraviolet. And so things that look like some of the flowers on the shrine, they look like they're plain white. But if you can see ultraviolet, you might see, wow, fantastic patterns on them that our eyes can't see because we can't see that. So we live with all kinds of very active influences that are invisible to our ordinary senses. And so the fact that there might be other entities and whole realms of existence overlapping with this one, it seems totally reasonable to me. There's a very neat exchange. I often tell this story because I feel it phrases it very well. And so it's from a Buddhist conference in Germany. I guess it was about 15 or 20 years ago now. I'm not sure what date it was. But it was a kind of conference, but also a teaching session. So there were various different classes and workshops going on during the course of this conference, along with lectures and talks and so on. And this one particular Lama was giving a series of teachings, and his students were coming along every day. Either his regular students or other people from outside could come along and listen to the teachings. And anyway, so there's one student of this Lama, after 4 or 5 days of these teachings, the student was very concerned and was filled with doubt. And so he said, you know, Rinpoche, I've got a problem. Because I have great faith in your teachings and I really want to practice with my whole heart. But, you know, for the last 4 or 5 days, you've been asking us to visualize Tara. You know, Tara is the female aspect of wisdom, active wisdom. And so, but and you keep telling us to visualize Tara and address these prayers to her, and to be, you know, seeing the image of her and kind of talking to her and saying this and saying that and reciting the verses of praise to the, you know, 21 varieties of Tara and so on. But I have this problem, because if she doesn't really exist, then we're just talking into empty space and we're not really talking to anybody. And so if Tara's really there, then I can follow this practice with our whole heart. But if she's not there, then who are we talking to? So please, Rinpoche, once and for all, tell me, Tara, does she exist or does she not? This German student spoke with a bad German accent. So, and Tara, does she exist or does she not? So then the Rinpoche went quiet for a moment. And then he said, she knows that she's not real. Okay. So that I thought it was a brilliant answer myself. But if you pin it down, it's like I was saying yesterday, whether it's inside coming out or outside coming in, it's really you can see it in the same kind of ways. In the Japanese tradition, they have this pair of terms. that talk about describing the relationship between Zen Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism. So Pure Land Buddhism is called Tariki, T-A-R-I-K-I, Tariki. And that means other power. So that you're chanting your words of praise to Amitabha Buddha. Namo Amitabha. And you're praying to Amitabha, and you're talking to Amitabha Buddha as this entity who's out there, and so that you recite Amitabha Buddha's name with the hope that you're going to be reborn in the Western paradise where Amitabha is the ruler, and so on. And so that's Pure Land Buddhism is a devotional practice, and so that the power is outside. Amitabha Buddha is the source of all goodness, and so you're praying to that. And then Zen Buddhism is referred to as Jiriki, J-I-R-I-K-I, Jiriki. And that means self-power. And so that the focus of Zen meditation is looking inward. So you're not looking for the source of reality or power or liberation outside, but you're looking at it inside. And it's seen that those are essentially both expressions of the same principle, but different methods work for different people. So for some, if you tell them, oh, you got to get help from outside, they think, what do you mean? How could anything outside really help? It's got to come from within. And someone else might say, you know, you've got to do it all within yourself. Oh, me? No, I need help. You know, there's great beings out there and they can help, and I know it. So I'll do it that way. But they're not opposed or even very essentially different, but they're different skillful means, different upayas of drawing upon the capacities that are there. Either the mind creates an image of them being out in the world, or it creates an image of them being within us. But the essential process is the same, but different things will work for different people. Also, you know, those who say that the Buddha never really taught about other realms of existence, or that's all just made up, you know, the skeptical materialist Buddhists, people who like to think about, you know, there's only this life, there's no past lives, there's no future lives, it's just the sort of skeptical materialist Buddhists, and they're allergic to devatas and heavenly realms and such like, that they'd like to say that, well, all of that stuff was just put into the scriptures later on. But if you read the scriptures in a systematic way, you realize if that's true, there's a heck of a lot of editing going on. And that if you just take the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, I went through it once and just added it up. I did the statistics on it once. And in about a third, about 33%, of the suttas, there is some mention of other beings of other realms, different realms of existence, heavens, hells, devatas, Brahma gods, in 33% of the suttas. So, personally, I don't think it was added in later on. I think it is very much a part of the Buddha's expression of things and the world as he experienced it and others experienced it. So, but that's my subjective impression. But I feel that if you have a sense of, well, I'm not going to believe in devatas unless I meet one, fine. So it's up to you. It's important to know, well, that's a thought in the mind. Whether it's true or not is another story, but that's what I like to think. Speaking of Nagas, there was a senior Thai monk who once came to visit Chidhurst. And Lumpur Samedo, and I wasn't there at the time, but Lumpur Samedo and other Sangha members were all sort of gathered to greet him as he was arriving. And then as soon as he got there, he said, can we go down to the lake? And so they didn't really want to, seemingly didn't, he wasn't particularly interested in meeting Lumpur Samedo or any of the other Sangha. Can we go to the lake? And as they walked down, they found out that he'd had this vision that there was a naga, a dragon that lived in the lake at Chidhurst, and he wanted to go and meet the naga. Maybe there is. Yeah? Maybe not, but it was Ajahn Sumedho was kind of didn't seem to want to talk to me, just wanted to go and talk to the Naga. Okay, fine, yeah. Naga's more interesting than I am, I guess, but if he wants to meet the Naga, fine. Yeah. May he be happy. Yeah. So I think that's enough for today.